Today, we have the New York Times arguing that ChatGPT will have to start over because of copyright issues. Verizon is saying their 5G expansions will certainly help rural America. And we'll be talking to Dan Lawyer of Lucid Software about how AI is changing the way our teams can collaborate. Quiet on the set.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This Week in Enterprise Technology, episode 557 for August 18, 2023. How lucid are your collaboration tools?
This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by ACI Learning. ACI Learning has partnered with the best in the industry by adding insights. The new skill gap analysis tools is also there to ensure you that the training you're providing is actually working. Visit go.aclearning.com/twit. TWiT listeners will receive at least 20% off or as much as 65% off an IT Pro Enterprise Solution plan. The discount is based on the size of your team, and when you fill out their form, you will receive a proper quote tailored to your needs. And by Panoptica. Reduce the complexities of protecting your workloads and applications in a multi-cloud environment. Panoptica provides comprehensive cloud workload protection integrated with API security to protect the entire application lifecycle. Learn more about Panoptica at panoptica.app.
Welcome to TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech. I'm your host, Kurt Franklin. Happy to be with you this week. And I'm happy to be here along with my co-host. Want to welcome both of them. First, Mr. Oliver Rist back with us for one of his special star co-host engagements. Oliver, how are things with you?
Things are good. Weather up here is incredibly stormy and rain-ridden, but other than that, I'm doing fine.
Well, we're glad that you've made it through the raindrops to be with us. Also glad to have with us my co-host and our producer. We'll talk about that later, Mr. Brian Chi. Brian, how are things on your end of the neighborhood?
I'm doing fine. I'm actually finally getting out and about. COVID was not my friend. It really, really laid me out for almost 4 weeks. But I'm recovering. I still have a cough. I'm still sucking down cough drops like crazy. But yes, I have been getting your emails and I've been trying to reply as I can. And I should say to some of our viewers, every once in a while, even though we try to stick towards the technology and the policies and, you know, what the decisions behind the technology, sometimes it starts coming out like a commercial. So we apologize for that. We attempt to stay more on the behind the scenes view, but it doesn't always happen. So apologies for that.
We appreciate that. And today we're definitely not going to have anything that could be confused with a commercial. We've got a great guest. Before we get to that great guest, though, let's talk about some blips. Hey, do you use Zimbra? Then you may be in trouble because a phishing campaign targeting customers of the Zimbra collaboration software suite has spread to hundreds of organizations in over a dozen countries. According to an article on Dark Reading, Zimbra, a collaboration suite that is a niche offering with far fewer users than the major office productivity suites, has been hit by a series of security issues this year, and the new phishing campaign is simply the latest. According to researchers at ESET, since April 2023, an unidentified threat actor has been using scattershot phishing emails to cull credentials for privileged Zimbra accounts. The primary targets have been small to mid-sized businesses, which happens to coincide with the OpenCore software's primary customer base. There have been some government organizations that were hit as well, mostly, you would think, at the city, county, and state level. Now, the phishing email messages all follow the same formula. They say they're from the Zimbra Security Service, talk about a change in the login webpage, and close with a salutation from the very convincing Zimbra Boss Administration. The message has an HTML file attached, which directs the user to a generic Zimbra login page, but has some identifying elements customized for the target organization. And the page opens in the user's browser, though it is on a local file path, and it prefills the username field in order to give the impression that it's a legitimate Zimbra login page. Now, at this point, any user who types in their password will be sending the sensitive information straight to the attackers. To avoid compromise, researchers recommend standard security hygiene, using strong passwords, multi-factor authentication, and updating to the most recent version of Zimbra. I'll add one more. Hey, don't go clicking on obviously fake email phishing messages. Zimbra Boss? Wow.
So, despite all the tinfoil, T1000 warnings, and the fact that ChatGPT is already carrying not one, two kill it now lawsuits, as I think I mentioned last time that I was here, everyone is still making a mad dash to deploy AI. So that means new infrastructure. And according to the Register, that's already having a big effect on how data centers get built. So in a data center, the conventional heat dissipation strategies seem to work great for 6 to 10 kilowatt racks. But those apparently face plant when you put them up against all the GPUs that you need to run an AI training model. That's forcing data center operators to make some very serious changes. So the example that the Register used was Tesla, though it doesn't seem to be 100% on whether that's accurate or not. But they think so because apparently the Muskrat put up a job description last week for a data center program manager who'd be responsible for building, and I quote, first of their kind data centers, unquote. And yes, that's plural. There are a bunch of reasons Tesla might be building its own data centers, from evolving its self-driving capabilities, so supposedly they're developing a humanoid robot that needs an offsite brain. Whatever, though, all that digital thinking is going to be done on GPUs, and those are going to eat power like it's going out of style, which is going to keep those data centers pretty damn balmy. So Tesla wants a place where it can support, you know, their homegrown supercomputer that it wants to build, apparently for the same reasons that I just mentioned. They're calling the thing Dojo, and in July, Musk was bragging that it'll pump out on the order of 100 exaflops, which is a lot of floating points that you got to keep going. Any data center that's going to handle that kind of load for a completely customized system is going to have some really nasty power and cooling issues. So it seems to make sense that Tesla's going to run at that from scratch. Now, that may be a pretty or a semi-extreme example of this problem. But they're not going to be alone with this AI issue. So, if your boss is suddenly having really, you know, bright eyes when somebody mentions AI, it's probably a really good time, to figure out how all your new GPU nodes, are going to do when it comes to dumping all that heat.
Actually, you know, it's really funny. Oliver, Kurt, and I all worked on a InfoWorld article called Pimp My Data Center. And we were actually handling heat loads that big almost 15 years ago, I think. Anyway, so my blip is from our friends at The Verge. Verizon is saying, bragging, that it's weeks away from a major upgrade to rural 5G. Well, what it's saying is it's up to 200 megahertz C-band 5G spectrum has been cleared for use 4 months ahead of schedule. An upgrade, it says, will bring more bandwidth and faster throughput to its customers, particularly those in rural areas. The company will use the new spectrum to expand its 5G-based home and business internet business, in addition to improving its wireless phone service. The spectrum is available after the FCC validated the moves by satellite communications companies SES and Intelsat to switch to higher C-band frequencies, clearing the lower ones for commercial cell phone use. on X, formerly Twitter. People have recently reported seeing 100 megahertz of spectrum for its 5G ultra wideband service in rural areas like Intercourse, Pennsylvania and Bristol, Virginia, showing Ookla speed test screenshots of wireless throughput normally only seen in small sections of large cities. Verizon says it has made its new C-band spectrum available to 359 markets so far. The Verge has asked for a full list and will update if the company ever responds. Now, I'd like to remind folks that one thing that is contributing to this is the shutdown of 3G. In a large part of the continental U.S. and reallocation of those bands for the 5G shuffle, because this just doesn't happen with one service. Think of it like the so-called trickle-down effect, where bands shuffle around to make more space for services like the 5G ultra-wideband, where more channels are available for bonding. That's the key to the bigger, better speeds. This is especially beneficial to those areas with lower congestion, like rural America, where low user densities allows users to bond more channels together for better speeds, which ought to make our co-host, Heather Mo Williams, very happy, off in her little cabin by the woods.
Well, this is starting to sound like a broken record. The White House is yet again telling the executive branch to take cybersecurity seriously. In this case, it's ordered federal agencies to get their cybersecurity safeguards up to date by the end of the year, since they lag in their ability to implement President Biden's executive order, which was issued in 2021. In a Dark Reading article, they report that Jake Sullivan, National Security Advisor, is complaining that due to a lag in essential cybersecurity implementations, the U.S. government has been exposed to malicious cyber intrusions, and agencies that have fallen behind are failing to set a good example for other organizations. We can all rest easy, though, because senior officials have ensured the National Security Advisor that they're going to achieve full compliance with the security requirements included in the executive order by the end of this year. Prepare to see a flurry of statements designed to reassure the White House and the public that they're just on the verge of putting in place the best darn cybersecurity this world has ever seen. Unfortunately, security remains a, well, tier three priority at best at most of the departments. Until there's a major breach, it just doesn't get real leadership attention. Now, I hope I'm wrong about this one. I'd love to see some of our federal agencies have a fighting chance against at least the weakest of the threat actors lurking out there. Well, that is it for our blips. Bites are coming up, but before we get there, we need to hear about one of our sponsors from our leader. Well, Lou, take it away.
Well, thank you, guys. I'll get you back to your Enterprise and IT news in just a moment. But before we do have to thank a really great sponsor of this week in Enterprise Tech, and that's ACI Learning. 94% of CIOs and CISOs agree that attracting and retaining talent is increasingly critical to their roles. Now, with today's IT talent shortage, it's actually more important than ever that your team's skills be current. 87% of companies say that they have skill gaps in their employees. Now, the challenge of assessing your IT staff skills is really an overwhelming thing, but it doesn't have to be. In fact, ACL Learning has partnered with the best in the industry by adding insights. The new skill gap analysis tools is also there to ensure you that the training you're providing is actually working. Now, in a quick 1-hour assessment by Insights, ACI Learning will provide your whole team with key diagnostics. Now, this is a solution IT managers have been waiting for. In fact, with Insights, you can identify specific skill gaps in your employees and see where your team's weaknesses lies. Empower your team with personalized training, because blanket training really wastes money and time. Insights offer detailed solutions and support and strategy by issuing recommendations and training plans for individuals and your whole team. In fact, compare results against other organizations so you know where you stand, and test those skills and close the gaps with practical labs that allow trainees to focus on the skills they need most. ACI Learning helps you retain your team and entrust them to thrive while investing in the security of your business. More than 7,200 hours of content are available with new episodes added daily. In fact, ACL only stomps its competitors with 50% higher completion rates. These are the training solutions your business has been waiting for. Future-proof your team and company with insights from ACI Learning. Visit go.aclearning.com/twit. Twit listeners will receive at least 20% off or as much as 65% off an IT Pro Enterprise solution plan. The discount is based on the size of your team, and when you fill out their form, you will receive a proper quote tailored to your needs. And we thank ACI Learning for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Back to you guys.
Thanks, Lou. We appreciate it. We'll hear from Lou again later on. But before then, we need to talk about something that, well, I don't know that anyone else in the tech industry is talking about. It's this radical new thing called generative AI. Might have heard of it, ChatGPT, all of that. Out at Black Hat and DEF CON last week, pretty much everyone was talking about it. And there are just a whole host of issues that these technologies bring up. We'll talk about some of them later on. But right now, we've got a bite where the New York Times is going to help us talk about the legal aspect. Now, several weeks back, New York Times updated its terms of service, that's TOS, to prohibit AI companies like OpenAI, that's the company behind ChatGPT, from scanning its articles and images, using them to train AI models. Now, after doing that, it seems like the Times may be preparing to sue OpenAI. And according to some experts, the results could be devastating to OpenAI, including the making them destroy ChatGPT's data set and fines that go up to $150,000 per infringing piece of content. Now, NPR, which was one of the companies that broke the story, spoke to a couple of people with direct knowledge who said that the Times lawyers are mulling whether a lawsuit might be necessary to protect intellectual property rights. Now, this is frankly a long, deep, loud echo of some of the lawsuits, some of the issues that have been around since companies like Google started crawling the internet and scraping content to put into their search engines. This is especially true when they go beyond merely putting a link and a title and actually put some of the contents on the page, on the search page. There's a very real question about just how much of the material that is on the internet can be used by an automated process that goes out and gets this. Now, there are book authors who have been looking at this. There are all kinds of companies, and they say that the Times is primarily worried that ChatGPT could use the New York Times material to become a competitor to the New York Times. For, you know, why would you subscribe to the Times if you could just ask ChatGPT to summarize the articles from the Times, which is something that you could do. Now, ChatGPT is going to probably claim that it's using the fair use exemption. This one's going to get complicated. It really is. Now, some companies, Associated Press is one, have struck deals with OpenAI. So they are licensing their content to OpenAI. They are, we can assume, getting some sort of royalty every time some of their content is crawled. This is an issue for the large language model or generative AI because the larger the sample of data that feeds the model, the more accurate and useful the model becomes. So there is not only an economic, but a technological incentive to go out and hoover up all the data that's available. There is likewise some real incentive to make sure, if you're an original content producer, that that content is not effectively used against you. And words aren't the only thing. One of the major issues in the SAG-AFTRA strike is how actors' likenesses can be used after they are recorded. Now, this is not such a huge deal for the Brad Pitts of the world. They have high-paid lawyers and agents to negotiate such a thing. But I've seen several people give the example of an extra in a film who signs a thing saying that as an extra, they can be scanned and their likeness can be used in case they need to recreate them a few dozen times in a crowd scene. But once that image is scanned, how often can it be used? And if that person should become famous later, can the studio just go back to their extras reel, pull the image, and use AI to animate it without paying the actor any additional money? Big, big issues. So I want to go, Oliver, I just have the strange feeling that this is the sort of thing about which you might have an opinion. So do you think that companies like The Times have a real issue here? Is this something that they should be able to control how their articles are used? Or, you know, is this simply fish wrapper that they shouldn't be worried about someone else using the day after it's published?
Definitely be worried about it. So even before AI, if I'm writing for PC Mag, we would have this issue where these podunk sites, usually in Asia, would grab an entire article word for word, stick it on their site, sometimes with my name on it, sometimes with their own, and then we'd have to send them a cease and desist. But if they just paraphrase the article and link back, we wouldn't bother. In fact, we'd like it. So the question is, how is ChatGPT surfacing this stuff? If it's giving credit and it's giving links back, then fair use really doesn't have that much of a leg to stand on. If they're barfing up the whole thing, a substantial part of it, and they're doing it word for word, then, you know, no. But it gets even more complicated. Can they change? I don't know, but can they change how the stuff comes up? If it's just used as data for a query, and it summarizes that data, if they can turn that on and leave the word for word stuff off, that a judge is going to look at like, sure. I mean, it's that's fair use. That's anything up there. But the NYT, they have a paywall. And if you've ever been on NYT, that paywall comes up awful fast. You have to do, even after you do a free account, you get maybe 1, 2, 3 articles a month, and then pow, you got to pay. So, how did OpenAI get that? Did they get do a pay account and then just abuse the hell out of it? Or did ChatGPT bully its way through? Which a previous lawsuit, I think I talked about the last time that I was here, that was what they were alleging. They were alleging that not only were they grabbing, writing content, they were going after email stores, after medical records. I don't know what happened to that lawsuit, but if that's all it was doing, basically finding anything that wasn't nailed down and sucking it up and then using it, that's going to be a big, big no-no. And honestly, I think you're right. I mean, it depends. If they get a nasty judge, they could be dead.
You know, this is going to be interesting, and I think it will be fascinating to watch this, because if a lawsuit against OpenAI is successful, does that mean that they're going to go after Microsoft and Bing? Know that Google is getting ready to come out with their own instance. That's on its way. Marketing. Are they going to go after Google?
Yeah.
This is one of those cases, and we hit them fairly often, where the technology has run way ahead of our regulatory and legal frameworks. I mean, we're way off in uncharted territory. Brian, I'm interested in your take because you and I are both book authors, and it's funny that Oliver mentioned the idea of somebody scraping. I remember when you and I sold the simplified Mandarin translation of our most recent book, we both agreed that we would either sell one copy or we would retire on the royalties. I think we came a lot closer to selling one copy. You know, what do you think as a creator of intellectual property about what should be happening and what you suspect is going to happen around this use?
Well, I think it comes down to our friends in Washington, D.C. And actually, I've been hearing rumblings that there's been unofficial conversations at the UN about this very topic. It's AI is on a lot of people's minds. Now, what I am going to do is I'm going to go back a little bit. Back when Netscape was one of the big powers in the emerging internet, one of my ex-girlfriends was one of their original programmers. And we actually had a conversation that where the heck is all this web browsers information going to come from? And then I had another off-the-records conversation with a gentleman that was actually one of the original programmers with Alta Vista. And we had a similar conversation. So this is not a new topic. Where the heck is this information going to come from? And how are people going to keep credit? And I'll tell you right now, the U.S. federal government doesn't know. All kinds of agencies have had information floating around in the government back channels. It's labeled for government use only. That how the heck do we regulate this and should we regulate this? So I'm going to answer this as I would really, really, really like to have more than a single digit royalty check for our books. So that's one. I'd like our books to not become the public domain because of something like ChatGPT. But I also think it's going to be something that's not going to have an answer anytime soon. My suggestion to our viewers, like always, is write your Congress critters. If you have an opinion, email it, write, call. Your Congress critters are looking for directions. They're trying to figure out how to keep people's intellectual property their own. I'm sure the New York Times case is adding fuel to this fire. I'm reasonably sure the Associated Press licensing deal has muddied the waters. So there's definitely two sides to this coin. And I'm of the opinion that, yeah, intellectual property needs to stay intellectual property, but I'm quite fond of web crawlers and getting information that way, being able to find things. And I have played around with ChatGPT and the generative art programs like DALL-E and so forth. And I think they're a really cool tool, but how do we keep it so that people can actually make a living? That's my big question. And I don't have an answer.
Yeah, it's one of these things where some very smart people are working on this, as I said, out at Black Hat and DEF CON. People were talking about these issues and a whole lot more. This is one where we have the possibility for not only intellectual property issues, but privacy issues, security issues, sensitive information issues, just all over the place. And what I think a lot of people are both looking forward to and fearing is if there will be regulations promulgated sooner rather than later that tell the companies how they can use it. Unfortunately, I think everyone is worried that if the regulators and especially the lawmakers get their hands on this, any regulations they're going to come up with are going to be wrong. They're going to be less useful than they could be and more harmful than they might be. And, oh, by the way, how about those artificial intelligence engines that aren't within the United States? What do we do with those? This one is a big deal, and I will be really surprised if this is the last time we talk about it here on Twiat. Well, that's going to do it for this particular bite. We've got a great guest coming up. Before we talk to the great guest, though, we've got to hear from our great regular host, Lou Maresca, telling us about another sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Lou, take it away.
Well, thank you, guys. I'll get you back to Enterprise and IT News in just a moment. But before we do have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Panoptica. In the rapidly evolving landscape of cloud security, Cisco Panoptica is at the forefront, revolutionizing the way you manage your microservices and workloads. With a unified and simplified approach to managing the security of cloud-native applications over the entire lifecycle, Panoptica simplifies cloud-native security by reducing tools, vendors, and complexity. By meticulously evaluating them for security threats and vulnerabilities, Panoptica ensures your applications remain secure and resilient. Panoptica detects security vulnerabilities on the go in development, testing, and production environments, including any exploits in open source software. It also protects against known vulnerabilities in container images and configuration drift, all while providing runtime policy remediation. As Cisco's comprehensive cloud application security solution, Panoptica ensures seamless scalability across clusters and multi-cloud environments. It offers a unified view through a simplified dashboard experience, reducing operational complexity and fostering collaboration among developers, SREs, and SecOps teams. Take charge of your cloud security and address security issues across your application stack faster and with precision. Embrace Panoptica as your trusted partner in securing APIs, serverless functions, containers, and Kubernetes environments, allowing you to transform the way you protect your valuable assets. Learn more about Panoptica at panoptica.app. And we thank Panoptica for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Back to you guys.
Thanks, Lou. We appreciate it. And now it's time to get, when we get to what most people consider to be the very best part of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's our guest. This week, we're going to be talking with Dan Lawyer. He is of Lucid Software. Dan is the Chief Product Officer. Dan, welcome to This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Thank you, Kurt. I'm so glad to be here. Appreciate the opportunity.
Well, we appreciate you taking the time to be with us. Now, before we start talking about Lucid, I want to take just a minute to talk about you, because we have a wide range of ages, experience levels, and experiences in the viewership and listenership of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Most of them want to know what it was that led you to the chair where you're sitting. Can you tell us just a little bit about the career path that brought you to Lucid?
Yeah, happy to do that. And it's a lot of fun to reflect on that. You know, my journey has been long. I've been in technology for about 30 years now. Started out at WordPerfect, which is a great divider, you know, people who do or do not know what WordPerfect is, right? And then moved on to Novell. I was connecting with Brian actually earlier, before this show, talking about some past history that overlapped with us at Novell. And it was at Novell that I first got into product management, and was over like fairly highly technical things. You know, I was doing product management for network operating system kernels and file systems and, you know, things like that. And then progressed into more consumer facing things over time. You know, my more recent companies prior to Lucid Software are places like Vivint Smart Home or Ancestry.com or Adobe. And so those have been a lot of fun, but it's been, you know, the last 23 years, all product management and increasingly product management plus some other function, you know, so product management plus engineering, product management, product marketing, product management, UX strategy, things like that. But it's been a really fun ride for me, to, you know, start way back in shrink wrap software and progress, up to now where we're, you know, predominantly a SaaS world, and at least the world that I live in, and to see how technology has evolved, and some things have remained consistent and some things have really changed.
You know, a lot has changed, and it's been interesting. You mentioned WordPerfect. I remember WordPerfect and its predecessors. So it is fascinating to talk to people who have no idea what the world was like before these original big word processors came on the scene. Well, you know, one of the things that these word processors did was allow us to collaborate, but even collaboration has changed a great deal. And I know that that is what Lucid does. Can you tell me a little bit about how Lucid approaches the idea of collaboration? What are you trying to help people do?
Yeah, I'm happy to do that. You know, Lucid plays in the space of visual collaboration. And I think the fundamental problem that we're trying to help people with really comes down to this, is that when people work together, they quickly discover that written and spoken language is imprecise. And so, you know, for thousands of years, people have looked for ways to bridge that gap. And historically, maybe that was, you know, writing on a cave wall, or more recently is writing on a whiteboard or a napkin, or getting into the same room so we can see each other's body language, some way to augment the conversation visually. Visual collaboration, and Lucid specifically, really focuses on how we help teams to see and build the future. And we think about how does a team start at an idea and progress along a journey from that idea all the way to reality? And how can they do that in a very collaborative visual way? And the visual aspect overcomes the imprecision. It helps teams to get to clarity faster. It helps them to get to alignment faster. And ultimately, it helps them to build the future faster.
Well, building a future faster is really interesting, because I think it's what all companies are trying to do. But how does Lucid approach collaboration in a way that is fundamentally different than any of the other collaboration programs? You know, collaboration as a category had been growing for a while, and then during the pandemic, it seems to have just exploded. So what is Lucid doing that is different than what some of the other companies are doing?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things there. And really, during the pandemic, there was immense pressure put on the patterns of how people collaborate. And there was immediate need for new ways to do it, because people were suddenly in different working patterns. Fortunately for Lucid and you know, solutions similar to Lucid, we were well positioned and already had solutions that knew how to play in this new world. And so I think the thing that makes Lucid quite different from other competing offerings in the space, it really comes down to two things. One, you know, I mentioned earlier that Lucid really focuses on this complete journey that people take from idea to reality. And Lucid spans and covers more of that journey, has more breadth across that journey in our functionality and capability than any other player out there. And so the idea that we can support the collaboration all the way from the earliest ideas through to where it's like out there, it's real, and people are doing it, that's the one thing. The second thing that Lucid is really known for and that people love about our platform and our offerings comes down to an underlying platform that has a set of data and automation capabilities. And so you're not just doing everything on your own on a canvas, but Lucid is doing a lot to help assist and automate that process. And even though you're playing what, you know, feels very free form on a canvas, that information can be data backed. And so as you are doing things visually on a canvas, it's actually updating the underlying systems of record or updating the other data sets that you need to integrate with other systems or to carry the work process forward and farther. So it's a combination of breadth of workflow and then the depth and the data and automation capabilities that really set Lucid apart.
Now, Lucid is, I'm assuming, a browser-based set of software, or do you have your own clients that companies load?
Yeah, Lucid is predominantly used in a web browser. We also have native applications for iOS and Android devices. And really the origins of Lucid started out when one of our co-founders got frustrated with, you know, another similar product on the market, Visio at the time. And his basic thought was as simple, which is like, why can't this be web-based and collaborative? And that was the origin of how, you know, our first product, Lucid Chart, came to market. Was, and so it's always been a SaaS-based, web-based, collaborative product from the very beginning. We've then expanded that portfolio over time to, you know, broaden it and introduce beyond Lucid Chart, things like Lucid Spark and Lucid Scale to cover, you know, a breadth of different use cases that knowledge workers go through.
I've got to ask a couple of things. Number one, you talked about the mobile clients. Do you have a good sense of how frequently people use this on a mobile device versus using it on the larger screen of, say, a laptop or a desktop, or I suppose even a large monitor in a conference room? I think we still have conference rooms.
Yeah, I've heard they still exist. And based on, you know, requests from some of our largest customers, I think that they're coming back into fashion. We have a lot of customers that, are making sure we have strong support for large form factor touch devices, right? So like some huge monitor, which is touch enabled, which becomes basically like a digital whiteboard, inside of a conference room, which we do have, and support and increasing support for those devices. But as far as, you know, deployment, it's interesting. I think the majority of usage is still in a web browser for our products. And we see patterns of usage. And I think what it comes down to is when people are in a heavy content creation mode, they're often looking for, you know, more screen real estate, more capability, you know, with a larger keyboard, their mouse, a stylus, things like that. We also, though, see a lot of that increasingly moving toward tablet-sized form factors, where people are interacting with the stylus and things like that. And then also on a mobile phone. The nature of a lot of the content, you know, you're doing a lot of pinching and zooming on a mobile phone if you're looking at, you know, complex diagrams or robust, you know, brainstorming sessions or things like that. And so I think that's part of what drives it, is that the use case, the use, what people are creating, tends to work better on a larger screen, whether that's a tablet or a desktop or laptop.
Well, I know with my eyes, I appreciate every square inch of screen real estate I can get. So I understand that. We've got a lot more to talk about with our guests, but before we do, we're going to pause here for another word from a great Twiat sponsor. And welcome back. It's time to bring my co-hosts into the conversation. Oliver Rist would like to hear the sorts of questions that you have for our guest.
Yeah. So since we were talking about it, AI. To me, AI and collaboration, I mean, thinking back on all the CRAP problems that I had collaborating with people digitally, to me, AI would be a huge boon. I mean, I can look at it in several scenarios and be like, damn, I wish I had had that then. Is that on your roadmap? And if it is, like, are you going to do your own? Or if you do third-party access, like the, you know, the ChatGPTs of the world, how would you structure that kind of relationship?
Yeah, thanks, Oliver. So we actually have a beta of our first set of collaborative AI features going right now, and anticipate later this year that it will be out of beta and fully available to customers. And that feature set is built using, you know, on the back end, ChatGPT. We go through Azure and through the Azure services to provide that service. And what the current service is you know, an initial flow of how a team can start out with an initial kind of brainstorming ideation session, progress through that session assisted by the AI, synthesize meaning out of that session assisted by the AI, create a synopsis of it, and turn that synopsis into action. So it's kind of this like end-to-end workflow of how you might use AI to assist you through a brainstorming session. And that's our first step into it. And again, in beta and will be broadly available and not too long from now. The, you know, I think how it plays out over time for us and as we've engaged with our customers, we see a lot of interesting patterns, but I will say like the most commonly requested things and things that are very much on our minds. And we actually have early prototypes of that people could go look at some of these is the ability to either through text or speech, just type or say something and automatically have a diagram or some piece of content created. So using generative AI to do that. And we actually created our first ChatGPT plugin that's available out there, available today, where you can do that. You can, you know, feed it some entry and it will create a diagram for you based on the entry. It's been a lot of fun to play with that. And you can imagine that, you know, working its way back into our products mainstream, where that's just part of how you use our products. The second thing that people have really wanted in our products is the ability to have AI almost start to become the interface and the assistant, similar to what Copilot is trying to do, I think, but to where you can say something or write something and I no longer have to be the expert at finding features in the product or whatever. I just have to have an idea of this capability probably exists. And so I'm going to ask Lucid to do it for me and expect that it will be able to do that. And I think that type of interface is really compelling to people. And is probably what the future looks like for a product like Lucid is, you know, the ability to just talk or type to it and it's the expert, it has the skill and it does things for you that you want. And then you engage in a conversation and updates and fix it and refines it for you. The structure of that gets even better though, if you can take, you know, these public LLMs, and combine them with private information from that company. It'll enrich the context. And that's really one of the core conversations we're having with a lot of customers is, and it really goes back to the conversation earlier on the show around the legality of these things and lawsuits and things like that, which is, you know, every customer I talk to, they want the promise of AI. They want the value of it. Nobody wants their, you know, their IP or the value that they've created to be given away. Without their permission. And so it's finding that balance of like how can you, you know, put the two worlds together in a way that protects the IP of a customer, keeps everything safe and secure for them, but still provides this amazing value of, you know, higher automation and capability for our customers. And I think that's, you know, that's what we're working on right now is figuring out that balance point.
Hey, Dan, that actually gets me a nice segue. I've got a question about APIs and your private LLMs. You know, a lot of corporations, a lot of organizations create their own knowledge base. How does one do that? You know, because every once in a while, a lot of conversations in different types of organizations are eventually feed into a help desk app or pull from a help desk app. And then eventually populate knowledge bases. But one of my biggest complaints, I used to work for Xerox. And one of my biggest complaints is not having the help desk tied into institutional knowledge. Do you see this as something Lucid could start solving eventually?
I think Lucid certainly will be part of that solution. And the reason I think that is today, as our customers use Lucid and they create content and they collaborate together, the end result of that often, like if you think of it from a certain perspective, the result of that is often becomes a blueprint of their business, a blueprint of how their business operates, right? They're documenting and diagramming the business processes or the technical workflows or the stack or the operations, like any number of things about how their business runs is likely documented inside of Lucid someplace, including their original ideas of how they even came up with what they should do and how they should modify and do it over time. So a lot of that content exists in Lucid. And so I think that can become available, you know, through an AI to the customers. And you can imagine like the security model that need to be overlaid on top of that so that depending on who the user is, they have access to the appropriate information. That gets more robust though, if you can take that and stitch it together with other content about the company, right? Like the Lucid doesn't have all of the content about the company. We have a lot of information about how the company works and that could be used, but there's a bunch of other information that's across all types of other formats. And so I think ultimately, you'll probably see the world start to converge toward where there's, you know, maybe graphs of these types of documents and files that get stitched together that become available to an AI. And then there's a strong security model at the top to make sure that nobody ever gets access through the AI to things that they shouldn't get. And that gives you a really compelling view into a business to where it's less of me like hunting and pecking through a knowledge base. To me, like asking normal questions, the AI understands a lot about my context, the teams I'm on, the projects I'm working on, and can pull back really, really relevant answers to those questions.
All right. So if I want to try and bring it in, so this doesn't sound like a system that's going to be driven from someone in the trenches. This is probably something that's going to be driven from at least the director level. What kinds of thoughts, what kinds of key note points should we be documenting, should we be getting ready in order to justify making this investment? Because it sounds like an investment. This, you know, this is obviously not a copy of Visio.
Right.
This is something quite a bit more, and it probably doesn't get licensed in the same category as Visio. So yeah, what are the decisions?
It's clear. I mean, there's a lot of companies forming policy right now to start with. One, they're excited about what's coming. They're also very worried about making a misstep. They're worried about doing something, or especially when you deal with companies with lots and lots of employees, how do you make sure that every single employee is well informed of what they should or shouldn't do in terms of AI? So there's a lot of policy. I think you'll see then, software solutions to try and enforce that policy. A lot of the technology needed to do that exists today, right? Like whether that, you know, at multiple layers of like a technology stack to try and do that enforcement. But there will be, you know, new things on the radar. I think it starts with that, which is like, what is our policy? Then it's starting to think about, and if you don't have like really strong role-based understandings of you know, what people in your company are doing and what based on their role they should have access to, well, that's a place to start cleaning up. You're going to want to be able to think about based on role what people should be allowed to do and what they should have access to. If that's in place, I think that that transition to where there's some underlying graph with all this information in it becomes pretty smooth, right? You plug it in to that understanding of roles, you plug it into policy, and then, you know, select the graph system that you want to use. Which, by the way, I don't think you'll have to build yourself, right? There'll be many people that will offer a solution that way. And then, you know, that comes together and you're probably up and going. Now, you know, the time horizon on that, that's not a 6 month from now thing. But at the rate things are going, is that a 12 month? Is that an 18 months from now thing? Yeah, I think it'll come faster than we think.
Yeah, I did have one more. So I'm a contractor most of the time, work for many different clients. So Teams, Slack, you know, because I have gray hair, maybe someday, a long time ago, Lotus Notes. I have not used Lucid. However, that's what I kind of wanted to walk through. So like the Teams guys or the Microsoft guys have a really compelling, you know, Microsoft 365 play where their AI will put stuff from your meeting everywhere. How does that work in a Lucid environment? Like if I have a meeting, like walk me through, like what happens when I'm using other apps to, you know, turn my ideation into something real. How does that like work?
Yeah. So the way it works is we take an approach of integrating with a lot of these main systems. So with the exception of Lotus Notes, everything you named, we're integrated with. And so they play very nicely together and you can go back and forth smoothly between those worlds. In fact, specific to Microsoft Teams, at the recent Microsoft Build conference, we announced with them our initial integration into Copilot. With our AI and the ability to, you know, when you're in Microsoft Teams, to use Copilot to, you know, point to some Lucid document or Lucid board and ask for a summary in the Teams environment. It'll create a summary and give that back to you. That's the first of many things I think we'll do together to integrate the AI and our products generally in the Teams environment. We're integrated with all of the Microsoft Office products that most people are using today. As well as, you know, a broad range of other products. And so if there's a place where you're collaborating today or where you're communicating something like Slack, things like that, we're likely already integrated there to where you can use Lucid in the way that gives you the most value. And then that content can show up in the work streams other places, or you can start in those other places and come into Lucid. So it all plays very nicely together back and forth.
Cool.
Jump in and ask one final question. Human resource onboarding is the giant bugaboo for human resource people. And in my moving around, the onboarding process in every single collaboration tool I've ever used has been clumsy. Is this something that Lucid's been working on?
Yeah. Thank you, Brian, for asking that. It's I think, a point of pride, actually, for Lucid. When we look at our NPS surveys that we do, the most frequent verbatim response from our users of why they love Lucid is because of its ease of use. And we have constant investment into keeping it easy to use and making it easy to onboard and making it easy to go faster. But that's one of the reasons that we've been picking up momentum and winning in the market is because it is easy. And I think our business model is dependent on it. Our business model has a very heavy, B to C acquisition where we're getting millions of users coming into the platform independently on their own. And to do it at that scale, you have to be able to have somebody that you pull in through SEO or SEM off the internet, be able to come in and on their own get started. And so we from the beginning, we paid really strong attention to that ease of use and how people onboard. And then people, once you get many users inside of account, then it tends to consolidate and they want a higher level of features. They want more IT control. And so it goes up and then it becomes more of a B2B transaction. But it's those strong roots in, product-led growth, those strong roots in knowing that we have to be able to survive, millions of people coming in independently and onboarding themselves into the product that have created a constant focus for us on how easy it is to do that.
Well, we're getting down close to the end. I just had a couple of quick questions, and one of them is that so many collaboration systems are great, but they require a massive team for their deployment, care, and feeding. For yours, is your service something that's applicable only to massive enterprises, or is it accessible to some smaller companies?
Yeah, our product scales from one to tens of thousands of users. We have deployments across that whole range today. And the, models for how you acquire it, deploy it, administer it, scale across that full range. And so we're in, some of the largest companies you can think of today at full scale with tens of thousands of users. And we're on one person's laptop. Using it as a SaaS service independently. And so we have a full range of ability that way.
Well, given that wide range, how would someone take the first step if they were interested in exploring the potential of what Lucid has to offer? How would they get started?
The easiest way to get started is to just go to a web browser and go to lucid.co. Or if you're looking for a really specific app, you could go, you can also type in Lucid Chart or Lucid Spark or Lucid Scale and get to our individual apps that way. But any of those paths, lucid.co will get you there as a starting point, and then you can go and discover more.
That is super. Well, and we thank you for being with us today. We appreciate your time, your expertise. Any final words for the Twiat Riot, all of our listeners?
I just really appreciate Kurt, Oliver, Brian letting me be part of the conversation today. It's been fun to participate and to listen in. And I'm just excited about where this world is going. I'm excited about the amazing things that are happening with AI, whether it's on Lucid's platforms or other places. And also like really curious to see how this plays out. There's big questions ahead for us all, as this plays out. I'm an optimist about it, but I also, I'm a realist about there are some hard questions still to solve.
Lots of questions. Glad that we can play a role in helping folks find answers. Good on you. Well, we've been talking with Mr. Dan Lawyer, Chief Product Officer of Lucid Software. And we've been doing that because we've been bringing This Week in Enterprise Tech to you, our listener. You're the reason we do this. And the crew that has done it for you this week includes me and my co-host. First, want to go to Oliver Rist. Oliver, what's coming up with you for the coming week?
So right now, I just finished talking to Maserati about their strategy for EV, which I wasn't expecting. I was expecting a talk about a vehicle, but no, they're going to redo their entire line. So that story will be in Worth if it isn't already. And after that, I'm about to publish my first book in simplified Mandarin. It's called How Did Brian Get a Girlfriend Before Kathy?
Gripping, thrilling reading. We're all looking forward to that. Speaking of which, we go to the man himself, our co-host and our producer, the man in charge of bringing us guests like our this week's guest, Mr. Brian Chee. Brian, what's going on with you in your part of the world this week?
Well, I'm going to answer Oliver's question first. That girlfriend happened to be one of the very, very early programmers. I went to school with her at the University of Hawaii. And she was actually one of the programmers early enough that she had an Easter egg in Netscape. So that was kind of cool. Anyway, I've been getting comments from different people. Some of our episodes do get heavy on the marketing. I'm hoping the people that didn't like one of our episodes that went in that direction are happier with today. I think Dan did a wonderful job talking about some of the policies and decision making and why you might want to go to a more sophisticated collaboration environment. But, you know, we'd really like to hear from you. Questions, comments. I've got pretty thick skin, so you're welcome. I do a lot on Twitter. I still use it, even now that it's called X. And I'm ADV, NETLAB, Advanced Net Lab. You're also welcome to throw email. I'm Cheebert, spelled CHEEBERT, at twit.tv. You're also welcome to use Twiet at twit.tv, which will hit all the hosts. Would love to hear from you, and you know, show suggestions are always welcome. Take care, everybody.
Thanks to Oliver and to Brian. And over in the control room, we also have Mr. Victor this week doing our online TD and production stuff. Victor, what's going on in your part of the world? We know you're back there. We can hear you breathing.
Yeah, thanks, Kurt. I just want to say, like, one of the for Club Twit members, one of the other shows I work on is called Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson. And this week and last week, he did an interview with two THX guys, one of them the CEO and another one a director of product development, about spatial audio. So really good interview. The first one is free to the public, so even if you're not a Club Twit member, you can check that out. But it's a really good interview. So if you haven't listened to Home Theater Geeks in a while, here's a good reminder how geeky Scott can get with home audio.
Well, we are glad you are there doing that. We'll look forward to checking that out. And real quickly, if people want to find out what I saw at Black Hat and DEF CON, I've got some articles coming out over at Dark Reading. Also going to have at least one that's up on Omdia.com, and I'm taking the paywall off for that. So I'll be pointing that in social media. Anybody will be able to read that. Let me know if you were there. I saw some members of the Twiet Riot and would love to catch up again. Well, that's it for us this week. Thanks for spending another hour with us. And remember, if you want to keep up with what's hip, hot, and important in the world of enterprise technology, just keep Twiet.
Listeners of this program get an ad-free version if they're members of Club Twit. $7 a month gives you ad-free versions of all of our shows, plus membership in the Club Twit Discord, a great clubhouse for Twit listeners. And finally, the Twit Plus feed with shows like Stacy's Book Club, The Untitled Linux Show, The Giz Fizz, and more. Go to twit.tv/clubtwit, and thanks for your support.